from Ground Zero Radio. This is Democracy Now! Back from Exile.
The paper shredders have been worrying. The politicians are running like rats from a sinking ship. And Enron Chairman Ken Lay has just resigned, the latest in the burgeoning Enron scandal.
Congressional hearings begin today into Enron, the largest corporate bankruptcy in U.S. history. We'll go from Texas to India. Then part two of our interview with Vietnam-era photographer Philip Jones Griffiths as he takes us on a photo journey throughout the fallout of another war 30 years ago. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military has suspended transfers of prisoners from Afghanistan to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The move came after an international uproar over Pentagon photos showing a group of prisoners shackled, blindfolded, kneeling, and wearing earmuffs. Just yesterday, the president of the European Parliament suggested the sensory deprivation amounts to torture. The military is admitting that concern about overcrowding is one of the reasons for the suspension of transfers and that it's reviewing whether it still needs to blindfold the prisoners. But officials insist the suspension is not in response to the international outcry. President Bush told legislators they, quote, should be proud of the U.S. treatment of terrorist suspects. Meanwhile, U.S. investigators began interrogating the prisoners yesterday. The interrogations are taking place in a tent set up at Camp X-Ray, the hastily built detention center fortified by three rows of fences topped by coils of razor wire and watchtowers patrolled by attack dogs. American Taliban soldier John Walker is appearing in federal court today to face charges he conspired to kill fellow Americans in the war in Afghanistan. Lynn's parents, Marilyn Walker and Frank Lynn, went to jail in Alexandria, Virginia last night with lawyers in hopes of meeting with their son, but they emerged after about a half hour saying they had been unable to see him. Ken Lay resigned as chair and chief executive of Enron. His resignation comes on the eve of two congressional hearings and a day after the FBI raided the energy giant's Houston headquarters. Meanwhile, it's emerged scores of people who worked for Enron's auditor, Arthur Anderson, were involved in the destruction of documents related to the Enron Corporation. We'll have more on this story in just a few minutes. President Bush said yesterday he'll propose a $48 billion increase in military spending next year to buy high-tech equipment for a wider war. The rise in military spending appears to be the largest since the massive war buildup under former President Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. A White House official said the proposed increase would put $10 billion in a war reserve to fund any expansion of the war beyond Afghanistan. The Bush administration is also proposing to triple the amount of money the government spends on preparing for and preventing domestic terror attacks. The increases in military and security funding come as Bush's proposed budget projects a deficit of over $100 billion following four straight years of federal surpluses. The London Guardian's reporting the U.S. government is blocking an international drive to increase aid for the world's poorest countries in the wake of September 11th. With less than 2 months to go before a crucial U.N. summit on global poverty in Mexico, U.S. officials are trying to neuter the draft declaration, which calls for rich countries to raise the amount they spend on helping the nearly 3 billion people who live in poverty. The U.S. attitude has provoked disquiet among more generous donor countries and outrage among the development charities. A former Lebanese Christian warlord held responsible for a massacre of Palestinian refugees 20 years ago was killed today in a car bombing at his house. Eli Hobeika led the right-wing Lebanese forces militia when it slaughtered hundreds and possibly thousands of men, women, and children at the Sabra and Shatila Palestinian refugee camps in 1982. The militia was allied with Israel. Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon is being sued in a Belgian court by a group of Palestinians who survived the massacres. A mammoth cargo plane brought more U.S. troops and equipment to the southern Philippines. In Manila, Filipino President Gloria Arroyo security officials faced a grilling by senators questioning the legality of the entry of U.S. troops for possible combat on Philippine soil, which is prohibited by the Philippine Constitution. Arroyo won a crucial victory yesterday when she got consensus from top security officials and leaders from Congress in support of the U.S. troop deployment. Calcutta police say they've arrested a dozen Indian Muslims on charges connected to the attack outside the American Center. Unidentified gunmen had ridden up to the center on motorbikes, opened fire on several dozen police guards changing duty. Four police were killed, around 20 people injured. With Bush ramping up his so-called war against terror, the conservative Republican Congressman Nick Smith has introduced a bill to restore the draft for men between the ages of 18 and 22. The bill's being called the Universal Military Training and Service Act. It would, quote, require the induction into the armed forces of young men registered under the Military Selective Service Act. It would also, quote, authorize young women to volunteer to receive basic military training and education for a period of up to 1 year.
Rest easy, wealthy gentlemen, let nothing make us We give our workers tiny crumbs so we can keep the pie.
We pay off politicians so they bear our needs in mind.
And they line up to kiss our fat behind. If they're in kind, they line up to kiss our fat behind.
Don't worry, wealthy gentlemen, let nothing make us twitch. This new global economy's designed to keep us rich.
We ply our trade in many lands, let all their leaders come to bend down and kiss us on the bum. There's a good chum.
Rest easy, wealthy gentlemen, from Billionaires for Bush and More, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman, here with co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to all our listeners around the country as we begin to take a closer look today at the escalating Enron scandal.
That's right. And just before we do, yesterday I was walking down the street here in Chinatown. We're broadcasting from the Firehouse Studios of Downtown Community Television. And we're right next to the jailhouse. And I bumped into a bunch of people who had just come out. 47 people were arrested on Tuesday who were protesting outside the U.S. mission to the United Nations, protesting economic sanctions against Iraq and the continued bombing of Iraq. Yes, as we bomb Afghanistan, we're also bombing Iraq. The U.S. government, the military, just bombed once again this week. And Iraq is named as one of the possible sites for an expansion of the war. 47 people in groups like Voices in the Wilderness. Well, we are going to move now to Enron. Hearings begin today on the collapse of the Enron Corporation, one of the largest bankruptcies in history of U.S. business. And the latest stunning twist of the Enron drama, Ken Lay, the former darling of the administration and the energy industry, resigned as chair and chief executive of the corporation. Lay's resignation comes after a string of recent revelations have raised questions about the conduct of top Enron executives. Disclosures by congressional investigators have shown Lay helped create and oversee some of the financial arrangements that helped lead to Enron's collapse. Scores of people who worked at Arthur Andersen's Houston office were involved in the destruction of documents related to the Enron Corporation. This according to the chair of one of the congressional subcommittees that will begin hearings today on Enron's collapse. On Tuesday, FBI agents moved into Enron's headquarters to investigate charges of widespread shredding of corporate documents. The company's auditing firm, Arthur Andersen, already has been caught destroying critical files, but this was the first sign that Enron had organized a similar operation itself. Congressman James Greenwood, head of the House Energy and Commerce Oversight Subcommittee, has revealed that up to 80 people had received orders to destroy papers, calling into question Andersen's attempt to blame rogue employees for the episode. Document destruction of both companies will be the key focus of today's Capitol Hill hearings. It's believed each was shredding evidence well into last week, long after the government investigations had begun. We're going to turn now to Andrew Wheat, who's research director of Texans for Public Justice. This latest news of Ken Lay resigning himself and Enron itself being involved in looks like a vast destruction of documents. Can you bring us up to speed since we last spoke?
Well, I think you described it pretty well. In the past week, numerous allegations are coming out from a variety of sources that that the shredding machines have been working overtime over at Arthur Andersen and Enron's headquarters. And I think what we're starting to see is, for one thing, it is starting to look like a massive cover-up is going on from the various parties that were involved in this scandal and that had oversight of this scandal. And we're also starting to see the initial results of the sort of response that management is taking to the crisis as they wheel out for the public, so-called rogue employees that they say were responsible for what was happening. The inevitable result is the rogue employees are not necessarily going down quietly, and there's a lot of infighting and people within management in these companies that are turning on one another. And I think one result of it is it is starting to out a little bit more of the truth of what's going on behind closed doors.
Now, Andrew, you've had obviously more experience with Enron there in Texas than many other people around the country who, for many Americans, Enron was an unknown until a few months ago. Can you talk a little bit about how Enron developed in Texas itself and its ability to influence public officials there long before it was recognized on the national scene?
Sure. When Enron formed out of the merger of two sort of garden variety gas companies back in the mid-1980s, soon thereafter, Ken Lay developed a vision, which was I think it's important to understand how revolutionary it was. His vision was basically that he was going to overhaul the way electricity is delivered to American households, that it was going to break up the old investor-owned utility monopoly system and deregulate it so that consumers would have choice in who their electricity provider was. And to do that, there's a couple things that we should mention about that. For one, this involved a massive overthrow of the entrenched interest of the old investor-owned utilities that were doing very well under a monopoly system. It also overthrew a massive bureaucracy at the state and federal levels that had grown up around the regulation of these monopolies. And the other thing that I think we should keep in mind is this was a top-down vision. This was not that consumers around the country were rising up and saying, I want to choose who my electricity provider is. And in California and Texas, other states that have deregulated their markets, they've given the green light, and there's been virtually no response from consumers. People aren't out running around trying to change their electricity provider.
But it was a deregulation process. It was, in essence, getting the government out of deregulation, but was based on being able to spread a lot of money around to government officials to get it done. And isn't that where the enormous power of Enron then mushroomed?
They had to overthrow these entrenched interests, both in private industry and in the government. And to do that, there was only one way to do that, and that was to become one of the leading political influencers in the country. And in order to do that, Enron used rather traditional means, but it did it extremely aggressively. And I think it understood better than its competitors the value of this, where to influence politicians, it's one of the best investments that money can buy, because you can get them for pennies on the dollar of what you can get in return.
Speaking of influencing politicians, Andrew Weed of Texans for Public Justice, can you tell us about the Texas couple, Wendy and Phil Graham? Phil Graham, the senator, Wendy Graham, and her connections to Enron.
Sure. The Grahams, I think it's fair to say that it's hard to imagine another married couple in America that has done more for Ken Lay's vision than the Grahams. And the Grahams are also a beautiful illustration of how expertly Enron used political influence. During the early 1990s, Wendy Graham was the chairwoman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and she helped, as chairwoman, draft a blueprint for the deregulation of energy futures markets in America, the chief beneficiary of which is Enron. When Ms. Graham stepped down in 1993, having with the commission just completing work on this deregulation, she went directly to the board of Enron Corporation, where she has sat ever since. And according to some estimates, Mrs. Graham received something on the order of $1 to $2 million. For her service on Enron's board after carrying out this deregulation. But they acted as, to some extent, a tag team, because in 2000, the year 2000, Texas Senator Phil Graham, who was the number two recipient of Enron money in Congress after our other Texas Senator, Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Phil Graham pushed through in late 2000 what he called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and he had initially slowed down passage of this bill until he got some concessions that concerned him that related to the banking industry. But in late 2000, December of 2000, when the entire country was focused on who the U.S. Supreme Court would pick as our next president, Mr. Graham helped attach this bill to an overall appropriations bill that moved through Congress, and basically had the effect of codifying the regulations that his wife had passed a decade ago, and turned it into U.S. law. There were members of Senate staffs that referred to it as the Enron bill because it contained numerous provisions that were specifically designed to exempt Enron's metals and energy commodities futures trading from federal regulation.
But the Grahams were not the only beneficiaries of the largesse of Enron, and we have on the line with us also Bill Allison from the Center for Public Integrity, who's been your organization has been tracking a lot of the contributions of Enron, and also Anderson, the accounting firm that is also deeply involved in this scandal. Bill, welcome to Democracy Now.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Could you tell us a little bit about the rest of the beneficiaries in the government of Enron's generosity?
Well, Enron was a player. I mean, I think it's fair to say on the state and federal level all over the country. In the current Congress, you have 71 members of the Senate who received contributions from them. More than half the House members got contributions. I mean, some of them admittedly were, in the $500,000 range. You know, I don't know that you can actually buy somebody for that. But it's clear that they spread their money around fairly broadly in Congress. And at the, you know, we know, of course, that, or we found when we looked at the presidential candidates in 2000 that Enron was George W. Bush's most generous patron over the course of his career. And overall, I think they've given him $623,000, we've reported. And then, you know, we also found, like, in the California deregulation battle, and this was, and I guess it wasn't much of a battle since the original deregulation bill passed unanimously, Enron had given quite a bit of money all over the state, including to Pete Wilson, the governor who was in office. They gave money to Gray Davis, his successor, to the legislature. They, you know, they were a big player there. I mean, I believe in Pennsylvania they were a fairly big player. Pennsylvania went through a deregulation process a few years back. So, you know, overall they've given just a tremendous amount of money around the country. And, you know, it's somewhat incredible when you think of all the politicians who have taken money from this company.
Bill Allison and Andrew Wheat, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're also going to go to India and talk about the effect Enron had there and the tremendous power it exerted with U.S. ambassadors to India acting as Enron emissaries. You are listening to the Democracy Now! War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
You must have done something, 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 something you don't want nobody to know about. You must have, Lord, something wrong. What you must have done something wrong. Why you can't find where you belong. Well, well.
Running Away, Bob Marley and the Wailers. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. In our last segment, we'll be talking about taking pictures of civilian casualties and how they get out or don't. But right now, we're continuing on the Enron story as congressional hearings take place in Washington right now in the biggest corporate bankruptcy in U.S. history. Ken Lay, the CEO and chair of Enron, just resigned yesterday. On the phone with us, Andrew Wheat, research director at Texans for Public Justice, as well as Bill Allison, who's managing editor at Center for Public Integrity in Washington. Bill Allison, the question of whether people like Phil Graham should recuse himself, if he should, what about someone like Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson? Enron's biggest friend in the Senate, sits on the Commerce Committee, received close to $100,000 from Enron. Graham ranked second. Or how about Senator Jeff Bingaman, chair of Energy and Natural Resource Committee, seventh in the top 10. What about Kay Bailey Hutchinson?
Well, I guess to begin with the Graham situation, it is a little bit different because of the position his wife held with the company, and that's, you know, an absolute must for him to recuse himself. Obviously it's troubling that you're going to have people who were beneficiaries of the largesse of this company now sitting in judgment of it and trying to get to the bottom of it, but bear in mind that what Congress will be doing while they're looking into Enron's collapse, they're also going to be looking at how federal agencies in the executive branch, and we're talking the Securities and Exchange Commission, there may be some oversight of the Justice Department. This is a congressional function, and if you asked everyone to recuse themselves who took money from Enron, you know, as the saying goes, you couldn't have a quorum.
You already have the Attorney General recusing himself, as well as the whole U.S. Attorney's Office in Houston recusing themselves.
If I can just say, though, I mean, beyond this, you know, I mean, I think it shows, you know, how wide this company's influence is. And if you look at, Senator Joe Lieberman, for example, his chief of staff or former chief of staff was an Enron lobbyist. This Lobbyists met with his staff three times over the summer and tried to set up a meeting between Lay and Lieberman that did not happen. But, you know, the contacts between this company and members of Congress, I mean, I think there is, you know, let me try to play both sides of the fence a little bit. I mean, you know, Congress is certainly a flawed vessel to try to get to the bottom of this. The flip side is that, you know, this is, you know, aside from the executive branch, you know, which obviously has conflicts, and hopefully the people who were supposed to recuse themselves have, although I should mention that Harvey Pitt, who's the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, represented Arthur Andersen when he was in private practice. The accounting firm has been implicated in this mess, and he's not said he's going to recuse himself. So that, you know, raises some troubling questions, especially since the SEC is supposed to give some oversight to these accounting firms and relies on them for accuracy, and the fact that he was very close to them and advocated a lot of their positions, that he's not going to recuse himself is somewhat troubling.
Well, that you're mentioning Andersen, I think, is critical to my point of view on this whole scandal, because there are hundreds and thousands of corporations in America, and you're always going to find some that are even more sleazy in their operations than others. But the issue of these accounting firms, of which there are only a few major ones that do all of the accounting and are supposed to be independent, the total corruption that is apparent in Andersen really goes to the heart of the corruption of our entire business system as it's now functioning. And, of course, Andersen was a major donator as well to many of these same political representatives.
That's absolutely correct. And you know, and I think on the House side, Billy Tozan, who's going to be looking into the document shredding today, was the top PAC recipient over the last 3 years from Arthur Andersen and contributions. So, I mean, again, you've got, you know, the trail of money, and the people who are supposed to be conducting oversight have their own hands in the piggy bank. And with Andersen, it's certainly true that this is a thing that goes beyond Enron. You know, the collapse of one company, terrible as it is for the people who work for it, and, you know, the employees who lost their 401k pension funds, is bad. But when you think that Andersen is auditing all of these other companies, and a while back we did a book on taxes, and an expert on corporate taxation told us that his hunch was about half of the Fortune 500 have some kind of offshore partnerships, you know, designed as tax avoidance vehicles, and these don't show up on the balance sheets. This is why corporations prefer them. Well, how many of those are actually to hide losses and to keep, you know, instead of tax avoidance, to hide the true financial position of the company in terms of not making money but losing money? And with half the country, or I think half of all households, in the market, either directly or indirectly, this is going to be a huge problem.
We're also joined by Teresa Amato, who's president of CitizenWorks. She was the national campaign manager for the Nader 2000 presidential campaign. You did an interesting piece at citizenpain.com, Teresa, about recommendations for reforms, starting with setting up a firewall and accounting firms. Can you lay that out?
Sure. I think your prior speakers have addressed how the Congress is really marinated here in corporate contributions, and they can't just return the donations and hold hearings. They have to get serious about having some systemic reforms. First thing we could do is start by protecting the workers. The Pension Rights Center suggests that passing legislation introduced by Senators Barbara Boxer and Senator John Corzine. It's Senate Bill 1838, and it would restrict how much money, employer money in 401k plans can be invested in company stock. The second thing is the internal firewall. There's no internal disciplinary system in the accounting profession, and so you have to set up the firewall that you mentioned between accounting firms being able to provide management advisory services as well as auditing services. That's what's gotten us into this mess, this deregulation of the financial industries and really almost the non-regulation of the accounting industry.
We wanted to also go abroad as we not only look at what's happening here in the United States, but what the collapse of Enron means for a country as large as India. We're going to go now to Bombay to Abhay Mehta. He's author of Power Play, a study of the Enron project. Now, the links between the U.S. administration, Enron, and India are very deep. Vice President Dick Cheney lobbied the Indian government last June to make good on a commitment to a power plant partly owned by Enron. The meeting that took place as Cheney lobbied the Indian government took place a couple days after Cheney saw Enron chair Ken Lay at an energy forum at the American Institute World Forum in Beaver Creek, Colorado. He's only admitting now how many times. I believe the latest admission is six. We can't find Dick Cheney, but Ken Lay could over the last number of months. Now, let's talk about that relationship, going back to U.S. ambassadors like Frank Wisner, talking about Enron something like 700 times, the U.S. ambassador to India, and then going on to be the director of an Enron company, Enron Oil and Gas. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Abe Mehta.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Can you just lay out the different connections from the U.S. ambassadors onto the vice president?
Two things. One is Enron, just as in the U.S., has managed to corrupt the political system in toto, and not just the political system, but the entire system in India in toto. So the collapse of Enron here, as far as we are concerned, is, you know, great news. The entire state of Maharashtra, 65 million people, were hostage to Enron. We're talking of very, very large sums of money. You know, a third of the state budget was hypothecated to Enron. We're talking very large sums of money. Since the beginning of the project in 92, there have been a series of both admitted reports and otherwise about the kind of pressures that were put on to India to get Enron in here. From the testimony of the erstwhile CIA director before the Congress, this was in the context of the Cold War, where they were trying to justify The Congress was trying to cut budgets, and they were trying to justify that, no, you need to keep us alive and, in fact, give us more money. And among other things we are doing for you is advancing the economic interests of America and American companies. And the example they gave was how they helped this American corporation gain one of the largest contracts in world history, which is about $40 billion, no less than that, in Maharashtra. That's the state I am. And the company they were referring to was obviously Enron. From, you know, that point, this is early, this is 93 at some point. And from there on, literally everyone who is anyone, whether it was Frank Wisner or the erstwhile American ambassador, the one who was appointed during the Clinton administration, Celeste, there was just a single point agenda. No matter where they would go, the only thing they would talk about was Enron, 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 and Enron. And, I mean, it was, for example, in Celeste's case, it was very obvious that he was literally looking for a job. He was at the end of his tenure. Over and above that, you have a regular political pressure. Now, if you look at, for example, the Clinton administration, the then chief of staff, Larry McMurtry, if I remember correctly, did much the same thing as this administration in exchange for a $100,000 donation to the Clinton campaign. He made sure that there were several phone calls and other things that we still don't know about. This was reported in the New York Times as well as, if I recollect correctly, Time at that point, to pressurize the Indians into, quote-unquote, doing something about Enron. You have, again, much the same thing, you know, last year or as late as November, the Washington Post story yesterday, where there's a task force of the National Security Agency, the Dhabol Task Force, that's the project in India, worrying about, obviously, one is Enron, and they are on record in these transcripts. For example, saying that we should use Treasury to pressurize the World Bank to pressurize the Indians. Or, there are two other examples. And they've given us a diplomatic demarche, I understand, because we, quote-unquote, the Indians weren't doing enough about Dhabol.
Well, Abhay Mehta, I'd like to ask you, in one Enron report, they mentioned that they provided $20 million for the education of Indian banking officials. Are you familiar with that little cash reserve there and what kind of education was provided?
Yes, of course. This was again in a congressional testimony. There was an Enron employee, Linda Powers, if I remember correctly, who, again, the context of the testimony was quite interesting. She was testifying, telling Congress that, look, you guys can, you know, don't cut off aid and so on and so forth that you do give, but give it to us instead because we do so many things and, you know, here's this third world country and we have done such a great thing, blah, blah, blah. The interesting thing in the testimony was that she's on record. Again, this is the congressional record, saying that they have spent $20 million over and above all project expenditure in, quote-unquote, educating Indian officials in teaching them how to lend. And Indian officials in changing laws and so on and so forth that are of, you know, benefit to Enron.
So that was the bribe money, in other words, for whoever
yes,
they had
course.
To corrupt.
I mean,
there's
no issue of that. I mean, we're talking of $35 billion contract with profits of 30 to 35% on revenues, completely guaranteed by the state, by all the assets of the state. There's no contract like this in commercial history.
So the IMF tells India that they have to privatize. They've got to break the government monopolies on providing electricity, etc. They push them into...
Quite.
No?
No, I'm sorry. This is, in fact, it gets curiouser and curiouser. The World Bank, there are about 8 or 10 letters that we have on, again, is on record several times telling in unequivocal bureaucraties, nonetheless, that you must be out of your stupid little minds to go ahead with a project like this, which will bankrupt your state and your economy. This is the World Bank, not once, twice, you know, four or five times over the context of about 2 years. Despite this, I mean, not only, of course, do we not go ahead, but we do exactly what the World Bank, you know, tells us not to do. So it's far more, it's not black and white. There are, you know, shades of gray in between. And the bulk of it is, again, very old-fashioned. For an amazing cash flow and a guaranteed one at that, Enron did what it had to get it.
And I think
earlier in the conversation had put it very well, for the kind of monies they spent, the output for the pennies, they got, you know, dollars.
Well, and also I think important what you're raising here is that it's just not the Bush administration, that a lot of this was occurring under the Clinton administration and the Democrats, that the corruption was pervasive in both political parties. I'd like to bring back Teresa Amato for a second on this issue, because clearly in the calls that were made by Enron and as the ship was sinking, they called Robert Rubin, the former Nixon guru, financial guru, the former Clinton financial guru, so that they were key Democrats that were just as responsible for a lot of the problems that showed themselves in the final months here in the Enron scandal.
Right. And, you know, the problem is you have corporate influence peddling. That's really why we need to pass some kind of, full public financing of public campaigns, or at least the partial campaign finance reform legislation, the Shea-Meehan bill currently before Congress. But during the Clinton administration, you had the shredding of the Glass-Steagall protections from 1933, because allowing commercial banking and investment banking to become mixed now with the passage of the Financial Modernization Act in 1999. You also had the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, which made it much harder to hold accountants liable. This got passed in 1995, but of course that was over Clinton's veto. But you have Congress that is completely marinated in all of these campaign contributions from corporations. And if you want to get serious about cracking down on a corporate crime wave, you can't have the people in Congress subject to the corporate influence.
And, of course, you mentioned Glass-Steagall wasn't one of the last acts of as Rubin on his way out of the Clinton administration over to the Travelers Citibank conglomerate to make sure that got through Congress?
Right. Absolutely. And so that's the problem, is that you don't have we have had two decades, really, of non-regulation and deregulation of the financial industries, and that's what's gotten us into this mess. And so we have to ask ourselves, how many other Enrons in waiting are there? And when is the Congress going to get serious about having reforms that protect the workers, the shareholders, the pension holders, and communities, you know, that are invested in these stocks?
It remains to be seen, of course, whether Congress is just going to go through the motions as it did with the savings and loan scandal, give everybody a slap on the wrist and move on, or whether, as you say, there will be serious substantive changes. Of course, that will depend a lot on how the American people react to the unfolding hearings.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We did see if the Heritage Foundation could join us today, very much advocates of deregulation, as well as the American Enterprise Institute, the Manhattan Institute in New York. None of them were able to bring anyone on. I believe it was the American Enterprise Institute that said they had Ken Lay on their board of directors. But thank you to each of you for being with us. Teresa Amato, president of CitizenWorks, Abe Mehta, author of Power Play, a study of the Enron project, Andrew Wheat, research director of Texans for Public Justice, and Bill Allison with the Center for Public Integrity. Today, Congress is holding hearings into the collapse of Enron. After our break, we're going to go back 30 years and talk about a problem that plagues journalism right through until today, and that is crusading journalists and photographers who make it on the ground to the sites of tremendous devastation, but somehow can't manage to get their stories and photographs back, not because of some technical glitch, but because of the political orientation of the editors. Stay with us.
Time will come. Changes will repeat themselves. History books piled on the shelves. Students ask, who will our great ones be? It shall be we.
Listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. America's long nightmare in Vietnam worsened considerably in 1966 with the arrival in Saigon of a garrulous and cantankerous Welshman by the name of Philip Jones Griffiths. Perhaps more than any other photographer covering the war, Griffiths showed Americans what the war was doing to the people of Vietnam. His thesis, articulated in an angry book called Vietnam, Inc., was that the war was destroying a society from which America could usefully learn that everything happening in Vietnam was being done against the will of the people, that 2,000 years of tradition were being replaced by an alien, materialistic democracy. Vietnam, Inc. was one of the most powerful photographic testaments to emerge from the war. It shattered many of the myths about Vietnam and had a devastating effect on the American perception of what was happening in that faraway country. It was what Griffiths wished. He said, "To me, there's no point in pressing the shutter unless you're making some caustic comment on the incongruities of life. That is what photography is all about. It is the only reason for doing it." But rather than quote this great photographer, let's let him speak for himself. He joins us in our Firehouse studio for the second part of this interview as we go from the war in Afghanistan and the lack of pictures we see of civilian casualties and the devastation there, go back 30 years to what one crusading photographer could do. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. I'm looking in your book, Vietnam, Inc., at what might be your most famous photograph, though at the time, not a lot of people saw it. Can you describe it to us while we're on cable access stations, TV around the country, and they're looking at it right now? Our community radio audience is going to have to rely on your words.
Well, I think it's a simple picture, and that's what makes a lot of photographs great, is simplicity. It's of a woman who was actually hit in the head by a bullet, and her head is bandaged, her face is covered with a hand that's fairly blackened. But significantly, she has a tag around her wrist. And what fascinated me at the time, although not at the moment I took it, but when I examined the negative, the person who filled in that tag was probably an anti-war GI, because She is described as VNC female. That means Vietnamese civilian. Now, the rule was in those days that anyone who was wounded was called VCS, Viet Cong suspect, and anyone killed was posthumously elevated to VCC, Viet Cong confirmed. So I was always fascinated, you know, as to one day meeting the man who filled in that tag, because he was obviously on the right side. I think, in a way, the simplicity of the picture sums up the dehumanizing effect that that war had on, and the way in which the foreign other, as Westmoreland described them, the Vietnamese, these were not really human. And that's the way in which so many of the people running that war in Vietnam felt about the Vietnamese.
How hard was it to get your photographs out at the time? Your book is famous now. It's been reissued after 30 years with an introduction by Noam Chomsky talking about how deeply he was affected by your photographs. But at the time, your photographs trickled out.
Trickled slowly. I think, you know, from 66 until 71, when the book came out, that was a period in which not a lot of hard-hitting photographs came out, especially in America. The press were always way behind public opinion about the war. And certainly in Europe, a few more of pictures were published there. But still, I think in the end, more of my pictures were sort of somehow illicitly obtained and blown up and put on posters by the anti-war movement and paraded up and down the capitals of Europe rather than in magazines where they belonged.
Let's go to another photograph.
Well, this one is a picture that it's not the world's greatest picture, but for me, I think it also sort of sums things up. It's a very large marine teaching Vietnamese mothers how to bathe their children. And there was that sort of cultural clash that came about in Vietnam. And I thought this picture sort of summed it up. The Vietnamese, of course, are very... couldn't believe that Americans only bathe once a day. They bathe three times a day. But here is this Marine actually showing mothers how to bathe their children. And, of course, he made a terrible mistake. The child is standing in a bowl of soapy water. And when he, at one point during this, just after this picture was taken, the grandmother whips the bowl away because, of course, he'd used the bowl that the mother would normally use for washing vegetables. You would never dream of washing a child in the vegetable bowl. And that's one that's always, you know, brought a smile, as it were.
Can you talk about going with U.S. soldiers when they would... go on there, if you could call them expeditions. We're talking about attacks.
Well, yeah. One, the way to get pictures, that's the great thing about being a photographer. You have to be there. There's no way you can debrief people returning from a battle. You've got to be out there with them every day. And I spent a lot of time with American soldiers, and I got on with them, possibly because, you know, I was slightly exotic, the strange accent of mine. I mean, in this picture, for instance, here we are. We found a Viet Cong who'd been fighting for a few days. He'd had a stomach wound. His belly had been blown out. So he'd wrapped his intestines in this little tiny bowl, which he'd strapped to his waist. And these soldiers, they're 9th Division soldiers from down in the south. When we came across this guy, they were so impressed. They couldn't believe it. And, of course, the Vietnamese interpreter said, oh, let him... He was very thirsty, the Viet Cong, because that's what happens with stomach wounds. They make you very thirsty. So the Vietnamese interpreter said, oh, give him paddy field water to drink, dirty water. He's Viet Cong. And this GI on the left said, look, anyone who can fight for 3 days with his stomach hanging out can drink from my canteen any time. And I was proud to have taken that picture because I think it did express some of the sort of humanity of the fighting man towards the enemy, the so-called enemy.
But you also describe situations where you say, what's going to happen to the civilians when you're with the soldiers?
Indeed. I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that all GIs were angels. On the contrary, one has to think of what happened at the My Lai massacre when Callie was asked, you mean you threw babies in the air and shot them, and you replied, yes, sir, in the air, at his inquiry. So they're not all angels. And here we had a situation where this Viet Cong was captured, and at the same time, this woman here was also captured. And as I explained in the caption, I asked them what will happen to her, and they said, oh, they'll rape her and torture her and then kill her. And I think, although he was specifically referring probably to the South Vietnamese authorities, there was little law when it came to prisoners. As far as the South Vietnamese were concerned, they just killed whoever they wanted. There was no such thing as the Geneva Convention. That was regarded as a little bit of a joke. And in fact, it was. I often wonder when I see these people protesting the fact that they believe that there are prisoners still kept in Vietnam. They always have these little parades around Washington with men in tiger cages, assuming that that's where they were kept. However, it was the Americans who invented the tiger cage. They were the people who actually built them, and they were used for the National Liberation Front prisoners. So I came across instances of torture and things, but it was all done on a rather sort of, there was a sort of county fair sort of atmosphere to the whole thing. It wasn't really, it was taken as very natural that one should torture prisoners. Well, you might get good information out of them. Why not?
We're talking to Philip Jones Griffiths. His book is Vietnam, Inc. It was just reprinted after 30 years, his collection of war photographs from Vietnam. This new edition has met with great acclaim in Europe, and basically to silence here. Why?
Well, I think that, as far as here is concerned, I think 9/11 has so overwhelmed the media. There's been it's a sort of reluctance to go back and examine history, although I think that one could learn a lot from the Vietnam experience, which has been overlooked right now. Also, I think that what this book does, and as far as I know, no other book does, is to bring it all together, is to show the complete picture. You know, when I went to Vietnam, I really wanted to do a book that would say, look, between these covers is all you ever need to know about Vietnam. And maybe from that point of view, it's still considered a dangerous book.
What was your status when you left Vietnam in terms of the Vietnamese government?
Ah, well, immortal words were uttered by President Chu. Life magazine wanted me to go back to cover, to do a story for them. And President Chu said, there are many people I don't want to see back in my country, but I can assure you Mr. Griffiths' name is at the top of the list. So I was never able to go back, never. I had people would go and check out, you know, what kind of bribe they would take at the airport. But right until the very end in 75, they just wouldn't take bribes. They just couldn't get in.
Why was that his attitude?
Well, I think that even if the average American reviewer didn't realize the significance of the book, President Chu, who, as you know, was the head of the South Vietnamese government until 75, I mean, he did, I think. I think he realized that this book was far too dangerous, and the man who'd done it was certainly not going to be allowed back into his country.
We touched in the first part of the interview on you somehow getting through and getting the photographs, very valuable, unfortunately much more valuable than photographs of casualties, of Jackie Kennedy when she was being courted by another suitor to be married. But can you describe that experience of how you, despite all the other journalists who tried, how you made it through and got the photograph of her visiting a temple in Cambodia?
Well, at the risk of sounding like some sort of paparazzi, I can assure you, I mean, you know, I get an assignment. I'm, you know, one of many. I mean, they say, look, she's going to Cambodia. get some pictures. Well, you know, you suss out the situation and the techniques you learn in Vietnam. You know, I applied. So I wore for the first time in my life those most ugliest of attire, the Bermuda shorts, the straw hat, the Hawaiian shirt, and the British Overseas Airways Corporation plastic bag with a lens in it. And I found myself, as soon as I got to Angkor Wat, I found myself an American girlfriend. And we held hands whilst I was snapping pictures of her. And at one point, I actually crawled through the undergrowth and got them smooching, I think would be the correct term.
Got who smooching?
Jackie Kennedy and Lord Harlech, her suitor that month. And, you know, I got the picture. And as I'm coming back from having got this picture, I suddenly, rather like in a bad B movie, I'm on my elbows going through the undergrowth and I see these shiny shoes. And of course, it's one of the Cambodian policemen, secret police, who, and I thought I was so clever that I was anonymous. And of course, he said, you've helped me to my feet, and said, it's all right, Mr. Griffiths. And how's the war going in Vietnam? And I said, well, not very well. He says, good. And escorted me back to my car. So, I mean, you know, the Cambodians at the time wanted as much publicity, if you like, for Cambodia and the temple and everything, whereas Jackie had done a deal with him saying, I'll only come if you can keep the press away. So, you know, you have to use your initiative.
Because of tremendous press pressure, they flew all the press up to Angkor Wat to take a stage picture.
Yes, what exactly. And the trick was not to leave, you see. So this is a long, rather complicated, I found another photographer who looked like me, put him in the car, drove him back to Phnom Penh in the south, and I stayed on in my disguise, which I immediately burnt afterwards.
But I think it's a very interesting testament to what you were able to accomplish. I mean, those pictures helped to support the work that would not be supported, was you going to Vietnam and getting the pictures of Kashmir.
Well, it's one of these strange incongruities of life, you know, that the press are prepared to pay huge sums of money for those ultimately meaningless pictures of famous people, whereas the pictures that really count, they have no appetite for.
Philip Jones Griffiths. His photo essay on Vietnam is called Vietnam Inc., republished after 30 years, a 1971 classic with a new foreword by Noam Chomsky. I finished that interview just after yesterday's program, Juan, after you left. An incredible book, an amazing man. Well, from Vietnam protesters to a Columbia University student strike organizer, you have made your way right through to today and being the leader of the movement to democratize Pacifica, and I think we've
yes, and you know, we've gotten quite a bit of reaction from listeners and messages, but this one especially I'd like to read because it comes from perhaps the most famous political prisoner in the world right now, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who's on death row in Pennsylvania. And on Sunday, he dictated this message to a visitor and a big supporter of Pacifica, Francis Golden. And he said, quote, I am thrilled and deeply delighted at the recent victory achieved by dissident members of the WBAI and Pacifica families. This is a victory not just for the beleaguered staffers, paid and unpaid, but for the listeners all across the metropolitan New York and southern New Jersey area who hungered for a year for the sound of freedom that was threatened by a corporate stranglehold. The battle to restore WBAI to its former greatness has been won, and it is a glorious victory indeed. I congratulate you all on this remarkable people's victory. On the move, long live John Africa, your brother in exile, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And we are no longer in exile. Democracy Now! Broadcasting back with our co-host Juan Gonzalez, which is just fantastic. That does it for today's program. Hopefully we'll be back on KPFK at our regular 9 a.m. slot very soon. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Miranda Kennedy with help from Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland's at the helm at WBAX.org and inside the studios of WBAI. It's a beautiful sight. Democracy Now! Broadcasting from downtown community television in the historic Firehouse Engine 31. Thanks to John Alpert and Keiko Tsuno. Also thanks to Manhattan Neighborhood Network, public access stations around the country, and Dish Network Channel 9415. That's Free Speech TV. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
We can say our time.